Fair warning, this show contains strong language and adult themes from time to time. Sorry, Jerry can't help it.
Sick Boy Wolfgang Productions presents The Offering with Jerry Horror. A deep dive into the history of film and its filmmakers. Mostly horror, always genre.
Stay spooky all year long at Strange Love Parlor, Long Island's exquisite oddities and curiosity parlor in Lindenhurst, New York. They've got some ghastly apparel. Strange Love Parlor supplies an array of goth jewelry, unisex horror-themed gear, Halloween accoutrement, monstrous purses and wallets, spooky pins, patches, and stickers, providing you with the most wonderful and the most strange of treasures. Visit Strange Love Parlor regularly to find the item of your dreams, or perhaps even your nightmares. Grab your ghoul gang and visit today. Strange Love Parlor in Lindenhurst, Long Island, New York.
It's always Halloween at the Haunted House of Hamburgers, Long Island's only Halloween-themed restaurant. At Haunted House of Hamburgers, they are obsessed with both Halloween and hamburgers, so why not have the best of both worlds every day? Salivate over their delicious hamburgers during Boo Brunch, along with their Witch's Brew and Crypt Keeper cocktails. Or take a stab at the undead desserts, such as Ice Cream Sundaes, with your bobbing for apple pie. My favorites are the Afterlife Alcoholic Shakes. I'd go for the Pentagram Passion Fruit, or the Exorcism Espresso Martini Shake, or my go-to, the Loch Ness Monster Lobster Rolls. This place is fun as hell. They even encourage you to come dine in, dressed in costume. Your kids will love that. Or that could be one hell of a memorable first date. They're not going to forget that, right? Here's a little insider tip. For a far-out trippy dining experience, ask your waiter for 3D glasses. It's pretty rad, let me tell you. Located at 330 Fulton Street in Farmingdale, New York, it's the restaurant that looks like a haunted house. You won't miss it, I promise. Make Haunted House of Hamburgers your year-round Halloween destination.
Welcome to The Offering with Jerry Horror, the show where we can have a quiet and frank discussion as adults about the things that matter to me, or at least that I think matter to me. Please take a moment to subscribe to our show wherever you get fine podcasts, and hey, stay up to date on future episodes. Coming up, at the 11th hour, producer Harvey Weinstein demanded that this entire film be reshot, rewritten, and recasted. This film notoriously had four huge reshoots with a cavalcade of young Hollywood stars. The movie's budget ballooned well over $50 million. Some will even tell you $95 million. This is the story of a legendary horror director who insisted that this film absolutely broke him and made him want to stop making movies altogether. Stay tuned, you don't want to miss this. Ladies and gentlemen, friends beyond the binary, it is I, Jerry Horror, the host of this show called The Offering. Folks, this is the season finale. I love doing this show. Producer Pete, ostensibly, loves doing this show. I drive him crazy, and I do it out of love. No, that's just bullshit. I drive him crazy, and I'm crazy too because I want to keep making more of these. Guys, get the word out about the show. Get out on the street. Tell a policeman. Keep telling people like I'm a fucking 40-something-year-old Karen. Like, go and tell the cops about The Offering. Tell them it's the best show you've ever heard. Do that. Whatever. I don't care. As long as it gets us some goddamn ink. Does that even matter? Is it digital ink now? It's digital ink, right? It's nothing, man. It's vaporwave. We've got some people to thank that worked really hard for season three. Thank you to R.A. the Rugged Man. Hip-hop legend lends his voice to the warning that comes at the top of this show. He is serious. I have problems. And if you've gotten this far, you know, there's always that thing where somebody says to you, like, oh, you don't want to get Rita started. Rita's crazy. R.A. Hip-hop legend R.A. the Rugged Man. Thank you. We appreciate you. It was really nice of him to do that. So shout out to him. Shout out to Sean King. He's off right now. directing his first feature film, which I believe is called Screamwalkers. Thank you. He shot all the video. It looks good. This is the first time people said to me, like, hey, your shit looks legit. But you're not. But your shit looks really legit. It sounds legit. You look legit. But you're not. What is it about you? See, the thing is, I like the production value. But it's something about you, Jerry. I think something about you're just a piece of shit. Special thanks to our good friend, David Graham from the David Graham Collection. He contributed all the lovely artwork that we get to see this season. He put me in all these different movies. Yes, of course, it's to a silly effect sometimes. We get our chuckles from these things. But thank you. Thank you sincerely, David. Like, people like me don't get to be on movie posters. They don't put people like me. I'm a little too chunky. I'm a little too not handsome. And these are things that I've had to overcome my entire life. But David makes me beautiful, and he puts me there, and we say, Linda Blair, fuck you, you're not on the poster. Sylvester Stallone, fuck you, you're not on the poster. Jerry, you're on the poster. So David, thank you for putting me on the poster. God damn, it means a lot to me. Everybody, all of you, the listeners, the people who supported this show from Jump Street, listen, I appreciate you. I see you. I love you. And I'm going to keep trying to do my best to produce a quality show that people enjoy. And you allowed that to happen. So it's on your watch. It's on you. The onus is on you. Jerry? Yeah? When did you discover that you loved horror so much? Horror has always been around me. I loved the Universal Monsters growing up. Had the toys, I watched the movies on Channel 5, they used to just run them. My parents were very liberal. I had very liberal parents, very liberal. So liberal, in fact, they let me watch whatever the fuck I wanted. And what was even more of a gateway drug, people like, oh, they wax nostalgic about VHS. Like, for me, it was like, they had those coupons. You know, you rent one, get one free, rent one, get two free, gotta get two old ones. You got to rent one new one and you get two old ones for free. All this shit. This shit just, this is with the coupons. You have to cut the coupon out. You have to give the guy a fucking coupon. I can tell you that it was April 21st of 1989. My cousin Karen and my cousin Eric decided to take me to see Pet Sematary. You never knew what the older cousins, like I said, they were always in charge. So you didn't know. Sometimes you got Police Academy 2. Sometimes you got American Ninja 3. Other times you got Cocktail. And you're sitting there with your cousin and like four of her friends that are like really hot teenagers. And you're just like, why do they like this Tom Cruise guy? What's so special about him? What about Brian Brown from FX and FX2, The Art of Illusion? He's got something going on. These were like weird movies. Like, and that was the thing, man. Like in the 80s, like they just took me to see these movies. They were like, well, if it's really bad, you just cover your eyes. If I was with my boy cousins, they'd be like, keep your eyes open, see them titties, get your eyes wide open, get as much gore as you can in your eyeballs. So when we take you back to mom and dad, you just cry all night, which wasn't far from the truth. So they took me to see Pet Sematary. It was a Stephen King adaptation by Mary Lambert. Love Mary Lambert. Great director. Doesn't get enough credit. Pet Sematary, watching the movie. And they make a decision, and I've always said this, there are two different types of directors. There are directors who will kill a child on screen, don't care, and other directors say vehemently, no, I will not. I will not kill an animal. I will not kill a child. So for me, I had seen all these different films, like even an American Werewolf in London, even the Toxic Avenger. In the Toxic Avenger, there's that whole sequence where the little kid gets run over on the bike, and it's amazing. Like, I love it. But there was something like, even though it disturbed me as a kid watching that, that was a VHS banger. All the trauma ones were for me. There wasn't that grounded realism. And I feel like the child in Pet Sematary, Gage, he's a little kid. That's a little kid. It's, you know, he's a little bit above a toddler. And when that 18-wheeler, that semi hits the kid and the shoe goes flying, oh my God, I started crying. I was so upset. I mean, it was... I had to be consoled. I didn't leave the movie because I had to see what was going to happen. But I learned in that moment that horror could be many things. One thing was for certain, even long after I left the theater, I was haunted by that image of what I did see, what I didn't see, what went into my lizard brain, what didn't. I saw a child die, and it profoundly affected me. And I was like, wow, I'm like, horror can be this, huh? But horror can be Young Frankenstein. You can even have horror adjacent, like Addams Family and Nightmare Before Christmas. It can be so many different things. And because of the malleable nature and the flexibility of the genre itself, it proved to be the ultimate genre. Because there's only so many things you can do. You know, you can do a romantic action comedy. You can throw in disparate elements. But when horror comedies hit, whether it's a scary movie or it's Shaun of the Dead, when horror comedy works and it hits, man, it is something special. It's beautiful. But I realized to myself, I'm like, there is no unequivocal doubt in my mind. I am a horror fanatic from this day on. And all they had to do was kill a kid. And who would have known, right? After the whole Pet Sematary thing, what ended up happening was I desperately needed to see Child's Play 2. And the first movie had freaked me out. It freaked me out to no end. I mean, I really, truly. I thought Chucky was everywhere. Was Chucky in the bread drawer? Was Chucky in the closet? Well, that's a loaded question considering where they've gone with the series. But that being said, it became the bane of my existence to see Child's Play 2. So usually you would ask your parents together. Be like, you know, sitting there, you're just dumb little fat kid filling your gullet with Captain Crunch. Hey, Child's Play 2 is coming out. Do you think we could go see it? And as a united front, my parents were like, no, it's absolutely not. The first one terrified you. Your uncle shouldn't have shown you that film. And it's better that you don't see it. So that wasn't a good enough answer for me, but I figured I would get them alone. So first, I cornered my mother. I was like, you know, she was doing laundry or something. I don't know what she was doing, mom stuff. And I said, Mom, you know, I was thinking maybe we should go see Child's Play 2 if we're over by Grandma's house. And, you know, conveniently, there's a movie theater that's related. Like, I knew these things. I was like a sick little kid. I was a sick cinephile as a child. I was like, you know, I knew it was like, I was like, you know, it's only 5 minutes away. And there was no map quest. There was no nothing. Like, I knew these things. Like, inadvertently, I begged my mother and she's like, no, you're not going to see that Chucky movie. No, I, as a mother, can't condone this. So I went to my dad and I'm like, hey, Dad, I'm like a salesman. I've got a little tie on. I'm like, hey, Dad, I got a briefcase. Can I interest you? Is this something you might be interested in? Seeing Child's Play 2 o'clock on a Sunday? Because mom's going to be like, I know everybody's fucking schedule. I know what's going on to the minute. I'm like, where can I insert Child's Play 2? So my dad's like, no. He's like, absolutely not. What did your mother say? He's like, she said no. She's like, no, you're not going to see the movie. Now, I didn't say shit for 2 days. And I was well aware in my little brain was like, don't say anything about Chucky. Don't say it. Don't say it. Sunday rolls around and I'm hanging out with my dad. He gets done doing dad stuff. I don't even know what dads do. I've never been a dad. So it's maybe he clocks in and out. Not quite sure how that works. It's a rainy Sunday. And it just so happens that I know because I've read, that was my other thing. On Sundays, they would post the new movie times for the week. So on Sunday, I would read the paper. I had to know these things. I had like these weird compulsions as a kid. I'm reading it and I'm like, wow, 3 o'clock. That's a perfect time. So I go to my dad. I'm like, Dad, can we go see the new Child's Play movie? Well, I don't know, blah, blah, blah. So we're sitting down, we're watching TV, and the ad spot comes on for Child's Play 2. And he's like, you know what? Like, it was his fucking idea. We should go see that Child's Play 2 movie. That's a great idea, Dad. Like, are you running for president? Because I would fucking vote for you. In fact, whatever you're down with from this moment on, as long as we see Child's Play 2, I'm with you. I'm riding with you, dog. As long as we get to see Chucky. So we got to see it. My dad really liked it. He was like, that was entertaining. And it is. It's a great movie. I still think Child's Play 2 is one of the best in the series. Sick plug, previous episode, we did do that one. It's getting crazy because we've done so many of them. Regardless, to this day, Chucky, still a presence in the Fenari family. Everybody loves him. I have a tattoo of Chucky. We've got dolls. We've got all kinds of shit. My father, God bless his soul, just got back from Universal's Halloween Horror Nights. He got to see the new Chucky attraction, the walkthrough. Said it was fantastic. We, as a family, on a united front, we support Chucky. If he's running for the next whatever, you know, even if it's governor, I'll vote for Chucky. Totally. I think that's the whole, that I haven't watched the new season yet, but I think that's it. Chucky in the White House. And where do you go? You can only go to space after that. After you run for public office. I don't know if Chucky's running. I haven't seen the show yet. Don't spoil it. I'll get there. Trust me. Too much stuff. There's like 3 horror movies dropping every day in October. It's absolutely nuts. I can't keep up. After the break, we are going to talk all about some hearty recommendations that I feel you should give a listen to. People always say to me, Jerry, what's out there? I mean, we love The Offering and we listen to it until our ears bleed, but what other podcasts do you listen to? Stuff that's horror adjacent that you like? Well, I'm going to tell you. Just hang on. I don't know if I prefaced this before, listeners, but happy Halloween. It is the season. I hope you're enjoying it, having fun. Again, people have said to me, what other shows would you recommend? What do you listen to? And I had to put together a list that I felt comprised everything that I listen to. And this is, truth be told, I listen to a lot of podcasts. Even my little brother said something to me. He's like, you've got too many podcasts in your queue and your YouTube is ridiculous. You need to unsubscribe to some of those. And I'm like, you shut up and stay out of my queue. Yeah. So these are shows that are definite recommends. They are the cream of the pumpkin crop. And you know what? For a lot of us, spooky season is not just 1 month out of the year. We do this year round. So in no particular order, here are some of my favorite horror film and horror adjacent podcasts. Halloweenies. These guys never disappoint. They have a round table of different hosts. I can't keep track of everybody. I know their voices. They do deep dives into horror of all genres. They started as a show that was doing like straight up from Haddonfield, doing all the Michael Myers, the Halloween films. Why could I not think of that? Halloweenies, whatever. it's a great show. Give it a listen. They go deep too. They go hard in the paint. Nightmare on Film Street. This is another one of my favorites. This is Kimmy and John who host this one. And honestly, it's funny. This is a funny show. Again, that goes back to the horror comedy thing. There's a lot of funny shows on this list. They cover all different corners of the genre. They're excellent. Really well-produced show, by the way. The Evolution of Horror is another one. This is a great show. Mike Muntzer, he goes deep, deep into horror subgenres. He does it like nobody else. And I have to tell you, if you're a completion person and you're obsessed with getting to hear all the nuts and bolts of something, Mike Muntzer really breaks it down. Heavy. The Bloody Disgusting Podcast. That one, we've got Xena, Megan, and John. And these guys don't leave any stone unturned. And what's cool about that show is they're usually exploring new stuff. Like it's genuinely like what's out there in the zeitgeist. It's cool. And they definitely, I think with the Bloody Disgusting podcast, where they excel is they do movies and stuff that you don't see coming. They're like, oh, well, I didn't think they would cover that. And to me, that's always interesting. Let's get on to the next one. Girl, That's Scary with Kat and Jazz. These two women, very funny. Again, I just watched all of their coverage of New York Comic Con. They really are hysterical at times, and they put their own spin on covering some of this stuff, which is always welcome. A little personality goes a long way. Say You Love Satan. They started out as an 80s horror podcast, and they're like a veritable Wu-Tang Clan collective of friends. There's a whole bunch of girls, whole bunch of guys. They do the big stuff, but they also do a lot of little known gems from different genres. Very funny show. Very well produced. Whoever's doing the editing, they're putting in all kinds of movie clips and sounds and scores. Really fantastic stuff. Sonically, incredible. Might take you by surprise. Horror Queers. I love Horror Queers. It's such a great show. Joe and Trace. They have some incredibly interesting conversations, and they do it from an LGBTQ+ perspective, which is nice. You know, you kind of get another side to a lot of these different projects and creatives that you normally wouldn't. That's also important. That's important with all these shows, to put your unique creative spin on this little gem that we call horror. It's not a gem, it's a genre. We got Forever Midnight. And Forever Midnight's great because you can learn a lot from that show. That's a good one too. I like all this. I see, that's why we do the offering. I like stuff where I can learn stuff. And don't be intimidated though, even though these guys are, they know a lot. It's a fan-friendly affair, even for the horror novice. So even for the uninitiated, you'll totally be able to pick up what Forever Midnight is putting down. Another one of my favorites, Friday the 13th. Okay, these are frank discussions about real-life horror as well as cinematic exploration from an LGBT perspective. Sometimes Friday the 13th, they get into things. It moves me. They're very funny. Again, common thread here. Very funny guys, but sometimes they tell these stories and it moves me. And I like that. Finally, last but not least, Movie Dumpster. These guys, they're great. Definitely cut from the same cloth as I am. Joe and Sean, they dig the trash bin to find the genre's bottom. And even if you think you've hit the bottom of the bin, there's always a basement. That's the way horror works. These guys are funny. They're informative. They're very down to earth. So Movie Dumpster is a hearty recommend. So while Pete and I are kicking it and maxing and relaxing, these are some great podcasts that you can listen to in the off season. You're only allowed to listen in the off season. You can't listen to them during on season. You're a offering fan. You can't, you know, no, it's not like that. But all of these shows are fantastic. They're funny. I've spent hours of my life listening to all of these people and they make great shows. And I think it's important that you recommend stuff to other people. Word of mouth is always the best way, right? As far as public relations, as far as advertising, word of mouth is, because here's the thing, Roger Ebert's like, well, I don't know. This is dead Roger Ebert kind of sounds. Well, I don't know about that new Fletch movie. You know, is it as good as the Chevy Chase Fletch? Your friend comes to you and they say, oh, new Fletch is good. One with John Hamm? Yeah, man, it's really good. Okay, I'll give it a shot because you said it. Even though Ebert said it sucked. You know what's weird too? They use like the whole Ebert.com thing. Like he's kind of like this nebulous, like he's still reviewing from beyond the grave. It's kind of creepy, kind of tacky in some ways too, but whatever. His wife just, received an award from Spike Lee. It was really cool because Ebert really championed Spike Lee, really got a lot of his films in front of people that normally wouldn't watch films like that. So that's always a powerful thing. So even beyond the grave, Ebert's power is felt. Okay, here we go. Are you ready, kids? Previously on The Offering. No, this is just the last episode of the season. Parting is such sweet sorrow, but we got to get on with it, kids. We got to get to the meat of the story. That's why you're here. You want to hear what old Jerry's got to say. Now, let me tell you something. All of these movies this season are a piece. Last Action Hero and Cobra. It's where are both of these guys in their career. So the parallel with this episode is with Alien 3 with David Fincher. Because it's two movies and two directors, opposite ends of the spectrum, different generations, working on movies that almost forced them to quit directing. And that's what we're talking about here today. This is a movie that I affectionately call Oops, All Werewolves. Even the dog is a werewolf in this movie. And it leads me to my final question is, if everybody's a werewolf, then nobody's a werewolf, right? Doesn't that, you know, like, kind of negates the fact. One way or the other, we're about to get this final episode going. Are you ready? Are you ready? Can you feel it? Can you feel the power? The Dragula? Burn through the witches or something? I don't know. We'll leave that to Rob Zombie. But in the meantime, let's go. This episode is dedicated to the memory of Wes Craven. Okay, so stop me if you heard this before. An Agatha Christie-style whodunit, but with werewolves, and Wes Craven is directing it. How could it go wrong? How could it go wrong? Oh, well then, folks, you ain't seen the 2005 film Cursed, which was originally titled Wes Craven's Curse, but then Wes Craven was like, nah, you need to kill that shit. you need to snuff that out. No. It's just going to be cursed from now on. It was him just erasing his name in whatever little way that he could.
I waited over an hour.
I'm sorry.
For over an hour, I waited.
Yeah, well, most people have friends who'd give them a lift home.
Billy, watch out!
Okay?
Do you hear that? What's going on up there?
Please let me try.
So maybe you guys should hurry up.
Ever since the other night, things are happening. Things I can't explain. Infected. You're cursed. Something's wrong.
The only way you can break the curse is to kill the person who started it all.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to scare you.
There are two truths to Cursed. It should have remained an R-rated film. It feels like an R-rated film. And yes, they cut it down to PG-13 even after the fact because we got to get asses in seats and we got to make sure all the little kids can see this movie because unlike those Scream movies that were rated R, this could be rated PG-13 and get potentially more people. And previous episode, Sick Plug Scream 3, Harvey Weinstein really wanted Scream 3 to be PG-13 because he's like, we need that sweet money. We got to get that sweet money of the kids. The kids got expendable income and they want to see. But when it's true, the kids do want to see, like if they're older cousins, just like me, they saw Scream, the kids want to see Scream 2. That's the way it always works. In some cases, like with Saw 2 and Friday the 13th Part 2, they outgrossed the original because there were so many new fans that wanted to jump on board. So yeah, the two truths to Cursed. It should have remained an R-rated film. And number two, it is the most 2005-ass movie I've ever seen. This movie opens up with Bowling for Soup playing. Remember them? Bowling for Soup. We're almost 18 years removed from when this film was made. And it might be closer to 20, depending on who you listen to. This film, from every frame, it oozes early aughts culture. There is so much, whether it's the technology they're using, the music, the fashion, it really is like firmly cemented in that era. And that's totally fine. I gotta say, the score for this film, there's like these attempts at doing kind of surf rock, like a Dick Dale kind of like motif, but it never comes together and it's almost like nobody gives a shit. So even the score is a mishmash of different things and these disparate elements from bands they were trying to get on the soundtrack. You've listened to all the previous episodes about the Scream films, Rob Zombie's Halloween. We've talked about Dimension Pictures and the awful, awful people behind Miramax, behind Dimension, obviously, is the Weinsteins. Bob was always meddling in one way or another, but Harvey Weinstein, obviously a nightmare. If this triggers you, I'm sorry. This is real life. We got to do this. Ostensibly, this is the end of the Dimension Films Miramax horror dynasty. Starts in 96 with Scream. Scream's huge. We do sequels. Then we get stuff like The Faculty. They just start doing a whole bunch of pictures. This is the definitive end of them making a shit ton of money on anything that they put their name on. Out of all the Miramax era Craven stuff, this movie feels like a well-budgeted WB pilot in some ways. Even the plot. It feels like it's a TV movie that's like a setup. There's an easy way to make this movie a TV show. They lay it all out there. It could totally work. Where was Wes Craven in his career at this point? He made his passion project with Music of the Heart. He felt satisfied. If you haven't seen Music of the Heart, it's the true story where Meryl Streep fights to teach a bunch of underprivileged youth from Harlem how to play instruments. It's a sweet little movie. You should see it. It's a recommend. Red Eye is a definite recommend, even though they marketed that as a horror film, even though it was more of a suspense thriller. But whatever, that's neither here nor there. 2000 Scream 3 had been a tough experience for Wes Craven. The studio interference was legendary. They made them cut so much out of the film. They added more of those action elements because they wanted to raise the stakes. You don't have Kevin Williamson. He doesn't. It's Aaron Kruger who writes Scream 3. Craven and Williamson don't get to work together again. That kind of sucks. I think at this point, after Scream 3, Wes Craven needed a break. And he took a year or two off just to mellow out after this whole thing had transpired. I think Wes was upset that he didn't get to work with his Scream collaborator, Kevin Williamson. It was really kind of one of those things. It was the sauce that was missing. As Williamson was busy with Dawson's Creek, he couldn't do Scream 3. Aaron Kruger had written the third film. And I mean, let's be honest, Wes was never really happy with that script. Wes wasn't even sure if he wanted to do another movie with the Weinsteins after all their interference with Scream 3. It was really a nightmarish shoot for him, but we'll get back to that. The first iteration of Cursed was written in August of 2000 by Kevin Williamson, and it followed the exploits of a New York City serial killer who discovers that his lethal tendencies are due to his lycanthrope nature. It was Williamson's love letter to Joe Dante's 1981 classic, The Howling. And by all accounts, this early outline or whatever he presented them, it was pretty good and actually pretty scary, dark, and grim. The studio meddling would begin even early on. Two young screenwriters would be tasked with rewrites, and even super early into the development process, this was happening. Sean Hood, Tony Gaten were ordered by Harvey Weinstein to make the film more like Scream. As Harvey's demands, they rewrote the script, removing the New York setting and more serious true crime vibes. And they weren't happy with that either. This is where everything starts. The genesis is the written word. We're changing the script. This week, Harvey wants it to be more like a true crime thriller. Next week, he wants it more like Scream. We're dealing on the whims of a madman. Wes Craven thought that this new iteration of the script was a little too similar in tone to A Vampire in Brooklyn, which he had made a few years back with Eddie Murphy. And the problem with Vampire in Brooklyn is very simple. It's not that funny, and it's not that scary. So you got to kind of pick a lane. And that's where horror comedy can go very wrong. And it's not a bad movie. I enjoy A Vampire in Brooklyn. Wes Craven directed it. You got Eddie Murphy. For a lot of people, it didn't work. It didn't come together. I think it was a little too ahead of its time. I think a couple of years later, might have been more well-received. I don't know. One way or another, Miramax wanted to get Cursed up and running. They pressured Wes Craven at every turn, desperately. Hey, listen, we got this movie. We want you to direct this movie. Kevin Williamson, he wrote the whole treatment. I think we're going to put it together. It's going to be great. The magic is back, baby. So Harvey Weinstein said to him. Craven was busy writing what would become the 2006 film Pulse, which that's a remake of Kiyoshi Kurosawa's 2001 Japanese horror film, Kairo. Listen, if you've never seen Kairo, it is scary as all get out. It's a definite recommend, especially for fans of the Japanese horror genre. It was so hot at the time. J-horror. Oh, yeah. Pulse ultimately gets made, the remake, with a different director in 2006. Pulse is a weird and creepy film. The 2006, the remake. Kristen Bell is like the star. It's pretty creepy. It's funny because Pulse has similarities to A Nightmare on Elm Street and Shocker, even though it's based on this Japanese film. So that was kind of interesting. Craven was actually pretty deep into pre-production on Pulse, the original iteration. Almost finished, really. The Weinstein brothers begged. They begged. Wes, you gotta do Cursed. You gotta do Cursed. It's the movie. It's the werewolf whodunit. Everybody's gonna love it. In fact, they wanted him so bad, they offered him double his salary to do the film. So from a financial standpoint, he knew it was a payday he couldn't walk away from. I mean, hey, wow. And they even told him, they said you can finish Pulse whenever you want to finish it. They reneged on that. We'll get to that. So Weinstein, so this movie's in pre-production. They're getting ready to shoot the movie. 10 days out from shooting Pulse. That's it. Weinstein pulls it from the schedule. And it's all the pre-production is done. It's shut down. 10 days before shooting, Can he cut through all the slow lanes, getting cursed off and running? So basically, Pulse, for the time being, was dead so that Cursed could live. Now, in December of 2002, a press release for the project described Cursed as a modern hip twist on the classic werewolf tale. Wes and Kevin are a dynamic team, and we are confident that their collaboration will prove to be a winner, Bob Weinstein said. Dimension Films also announced that Academy Award-winning special effects artist Rick Baker would be doing the epic werewolf designs. Baker had originally turned down the offer due to very limited time, and he had to create all the designs and eventually accepted. He accepted at one condition, and that was being able to work on his werewolves without any studio interference. In Harvey Weinstein's mind, it was about keeping Wes Craven and Kevin Williamson happy so that they could eventually ask them to do Scream 4. That was the plan all along. It was get them up and running, get them to do a picture, and then we'll do Scream 4, and it'll make us even more money. How much money is enough, guys? Jesus, these franchises. One thing was for certain, Cursed was now on the fast track to getting made, and it had to happen quick, because they had locked in a date for 2004 or whatever it was, and they were like, yeah, this is it has to come out by this date. We've heard this before. They always do this. They lock in the date, and then they're stuck scrambling to make the movie. The first of three leads to be cast was the 19-year-old Jesse Eisenberg, Christina Ricci, and Skeet Ulrich, rounding out the leads. Next was Scott Foley, Omar Epps, Judy Greer, and even old Greg Kilborn as himself, Milio Ventimiglia, James Brolin, Shannon Elizabeth also joined the cast. Listen, this is crazy. It's deep. I got it because it's like so many people in this movie. Ilion Douglas, Robert Forrester, Scott Baio, and even old Corey Feldman were added to the cast. But last but not least, Mandy Moore was added to be the first person killed off, just like Drew Barrymore in Scream. They thought, hey, Mandy Moore is a huge star right now. Believe it or not, in bit parts, we had John C. McGinley and Heather Langenkamp rounding out the cameos. Principal photography was supposed to start on January 27th in order to meet the already locked August 8th, 2003 release date. But delays in pre-production forced Dimension Films to push the start date back to mid-March. On late January, a new release was therefore announced and set on February 4th, 2004. With a budget of $35 million, Cursed commenced shooting on March 17th of 2003 in Los Angeles, scheduled for a 15-week shoot. Now, you guys are following this, right? Because in early June of 2003, after 54 days of filming and only 6 days left until the final confrontation at the Hollywood Wax Museum, Dimension Films decided to put the movie on hold because top executives at the company weren't happy with the film's ending or how the special effects were progressing, specifically to the film's lead werewolf. They're not happy with this werewolf. Stop the presses. Shut down the whole movie. Rick Baker was preparing the final transformation effects when production stopped, and Weinstein let his team finish the work in order for it to be ready for this new reshoot. We were doing some really cool transformation stuff, but it wasn't quite done. So I said, listen, if you ever think this film's going to pick up again, if you can keep a number of my people on for another month, we can have this transformation stuff. We'll put it in a box and we'll be ready to go. If they disperse it now, it's going to be like starting all over again because I need to have the same people. Weinstein eventually refused and said, I don't care. Put all your werewolf stuff, everything that you made, I don't give a shit. Shut it down. Shut it down. Put it in a box. This upset Rick Baker. Big time. The film's co-lead Skeet Ulrich was very unhappy with his character and the filming itself. He also was beginning to test Wes Craven's patience. And as by all accounts, we heard that Wes Craven was always a very patient man. But for whatever reason, him and Skeet Ulrich were going head to head. And believe it or not, Skeet Ulrich was not Wes Craven's first choice. That was another one of Harvey Weinstein's choices. He felt like he wasn't able to get Skeet Ulrich in a proper starring vehicle. He always felt like he failed him in that aspect. This was kind of his way of making it up to him. From all accounts, Craven had a rough time directing him. Skeet Ulrich walks off the movie. Rewrites begin, And with these rewrites comes consequences, because you listen to The Offering, you know how this works. When production shut down and resumed with a new script, new roles were added and others were rewritten. Skeet Ulrich was unsatisfied with his character's transformation and ultimately had his agent drop him from the film. Oof, not good. So now your leading man is gone. This gets weirder. On December 1st of 2003, Joshua Jackson was cast as the new male lead, renamed Jack and retooled as Ellie's boyfriend. So he's playing a completely different character. This is so weird. I can't believe they did this, but it happened. Miramax really wanted Joshua Jackson to be a Ben Affleck level leading man. That was their goal with Joshua Jackson. Bob Weinstein loved the kid. It was the same thing like Harvey loved Skeet Ulrich, but Bob had better, usually had better choices. He was a big supporter of Ben Affleck and Matt Damon. And they were like, who's the next guy? Who's the next guy we can control for like another three or four pictures? And Joshua Jackson was that guy. So we got him on board as the other male lead, along with Portia de Rossi, who replaces Ileana Douglas as the gypsy, Zella. Smallville regular, Michael Rosenbaum, who I could just say, Michael Rosenbaum is the most annoying character in this movie. He's a red herring the whole movie. His character just comes off. It's like the most early aughts douchebag shit. I hate it. So he's taking over as James Callahan, as Ellie's assistant, now named Kyle. So just to add to it, this guy's named fucking Kyle in the movie. Oh, and hey, we lost Mandy Moore. She goes on to shoot Entourage and be an Aquaman. And we get R&B singer Maya, if you remember. Most people know her from Ghetto Superstar. She had a bunch of R&B hits. She was a thing. They were trying to make her a thing. The Weinsteins were like, we like Maya. Yeah, fucking we'll put her in there. And don't forget, we got Lance Bass of NSYNC is in this film. He joined the cast, you know, as a cameo appearance as himself. They really thought that was a lot of juice in 2004. Oh, we got Lance Bass and Maya. These are all like the B string, you know, and that's nothing against them. But these are not, it's not getting Justin Timberlake, you know, or Lil' Kim. I would have loved, Lil' Kim would have fucking killed it in this movie. That would have been amazing. That's a movie, Cursed, starring Lil' Kim. Scott Foley was originally supposed to reprise the role of Kyle, but now he turned into Ellie's assistant. And ultimately, Scott Foley just drops out of the movie. He says, you know what? I'm not doing this. I have other commitments. Fuck you. Also in that same category, James Brolin, Robert Forrester, Corey Feldman, Omar Epps, Heather Langenkamp, and John C. McGinley were all written out from the new version of the script, and they couldn't reprise their roles. So, holy shit. Like, you just lost. You changed the whole movie. Don't even say like, oh, we made some changes. We made a couple little snippets. No. When you write out this many characters out of a movie, it's a different movie. Yeah, we kept the gypsy. The gypsy worked. Oh, yeah. So you got rid of Ileana Douglas and you got Portia de Rossi. And she's great, but she's given nothing to do. It's such a trope. It definitely comes from that whole Wolfman thing where it's like, oh, this is the wise old gypsy who's going to warn you. You know, the soothsayer. It's like the guy, you know, the guy from Friday the 13th. The old guy, you know, crazy Ralph. And crazy Ralph's like, oh, you got to stay away from the old Bates Motel. It's haunted. You got to have that character. The warning, the harbinger of doom, so to speak. What Harvey Weinstein, speaking of harbingers, Harvey Weinstein demanded that more beautiful women be added to the production. And I'm serious. Like, this actually fucking happened. And if you watch this movie, there are so many bodacious babes. And that was all at the request of fucking Harvey Weinstein. And how do I know? Because there's a whole story about how he got Shannon Elizabeth in this movie. He was just yelling at his assistant, get the girl with the boobs from American Pie. Get the boob girl from... and they literally... It is what it is. Editor Patrick Lussier, he's a frequent collaborator of Craven. He had just finished working on reshoots of Darkness Falls, and then he was brought in to Cursed. Now, Darkness Falls is another movie that completely changes, and they change the creature, and I hate to say it, but sooner or later there will be a Darkness Falls Offering episode. So, sick plug, tip of the hat to the future. Hey, and don't forget, folks, we got bite size offerings coming soon to social media. It's going to be on all the social medias. We're doing a Darkness Fall, so that's pretty cool. Check that out. Patrick Lussier brought in to work on Cursed, where he was nearing the end of its principal photography. So according to Lussier, the unfinished original version of the film ran about 90 minutes long, and the only thing it was missing, besides the ending, was the score and the visual effects. Now, the movie was put back into a development phase during which all parties discussed on the outcome. Several options were considered, including shooting the final confrontation as it was originally written, or we transform the script into something different, saving as much filmed footage as possible. Now, one alternative was to turn the characters of Jesse Eisenberg and John C. McGinley into werewolf hunters. Okay. Ultimately, the original screenplay undergoes this incredible major, major rewrite, and it turns Ellie and Jimmy into estranged siblings, and it morphed the Vince character into Ellie's mysterious boyfriend, Jake, Joshua Jackson. From those 90 minutes, the new version only included 12 minutes of the original footage. So they remade a whole movie. They basically made this movie twice, okay? And if we're not counting, so they basically made 2.5 versions of Cursed, which is like the craziest thing. This movie was originally supposed to be like a $40 million to $50 million budget. By all accounts, I've heard $95 million on this budget, which means they made two different versions of Cursed. And it's just a weird... This is one of the weirdest things. Like when I started doing this offering show, Cursed was always on the list. Because the fact, we've never had this happen. In the history, in the three seasons of this show, we've never had a movie that was pretty much shot and then reshot. And they spent all the money on it. They spent all the money. People got money. It's the early 2000s. I don't know. People got money. After a tentative September restart, the movie officially went back into production on November 17th of 2003. Quite an extraordinary amount of new material is going to be shot. And a lot of the material we already shot, well, that's going to be thrown away. That's what Craven said at the time. All the Hollywood media outlets like Entertainment Tonight, all of them, they dug into this story big time because they realized, like, wait a second, you guys stopped shooting. Now you're shooting again. But wait, there's a different lead. Like, wait, what? Wait, who's in this movie? Who's not in this movie? Rick Baker, who had created the original werewolf design, he leaves the project because of schedule conflicts. And then fan favorites of the show, K&B Effects, come on board to oversee all of the new makeup effects. So we just threw out all this money we spent, millions of dollars. Academy Award winner Rick Baker. You know what? Let's just throw stuff in the garbage. Who cares? Fuck him. Fuck him and those apes from Greystoke. Oh, man. You know what's better than this? What's better than this is that TV show Werewolf that used to be on Fox. I love that show. And those were Rick Baker werewolves. Those were great. I love the werewolf design in those. Oh, my God. Let us reboot it. Let producer Pete, and we'll write it. We'll fucking write it for you. Fox, call us right now. Right now. We're stopping the episode. We're writing the werewolf reboot for Fox. On January 17th, 2004, the extensive reshoot finally wrapped. Everybody was burnt out. And you know who's the most burnt out in this movie? It's Christina Ricci. Because by the time you start to get to the end of this movie, Christina Ricci is literally like halfway through this movie. She's like, I'm done with this movie. Mentally, I'm not here. And I think a lot like Jesse Eisenberg, it's the same. I'm performing and I'm giving you what I can give you. But this is the second time we've made this movie and I'm fucking over it. So the new ending of the film was much more emotional and tragic and featured Jackson's character begging his girlfriend Ellie to kill him and end the curse. Kill me. It's romanticism. It's the old world stuff. We love this. I have a curse. You have to kill me. It's the only way you can be free, but I love you. What do I do? I don't know what to do. Now, an article about the film in Fangoria's 241st issue included pictures of a head prop for Jake's original death scene. From all versions of the film, which were test screened to audiences, excluding the original version, which was never test screened, this one scored the highest, but Dimension Films was dissatisfied with it and they demanded a new one. Allegedly, This first version of Cursed was never screened, just so we all know that. It must have been that bad, or either they really just didn't like it and it didn't work and they had fuck you money at that point and just say, we'll start it over, who cares? We already paid Wes twice. Now you see, we paid Wes twice because he had to make two movies. You got to wonder about that. They do multiple test screenings, and Dimension Films were just dissatisfied with all of them. What actually ends up happening is Patrick Lussier recuts this film. And then they screen that version, and that's the version that we see today that you go and you can buy the Blu-ray or whatever. And that's ultimately what we got. And they said that that one was the one that tested highest, so that's the one we're going to release. Now, Jesse Eisenberg, along with Christina Ricci, they were some of the few actors that got to work in all what they consider now, because now it's not just two. They're saying there's three different iterations of this film. The crazy part is that after we filmed the whole second version of the film, we had to go back for a third reshoot, which lasted another 20 days. That's like the length of an independent film. And then we had to go back and forth for a fourth time. And that was a 10-day shoot. At that point, once they had hit the fourth reshoot, the crew made shirts that said, Cursed 4, back for more. And it was never ending. This was just one of these movies that went on forever. I mean, come on, you made it twice, and then you had a series. Oh, God, it just doesn't go. So the new ending in this movie depicts Jake as the main villain. He's willing to kill both Ellie and Jimmy. And according to Patrick Lussier, the final budget for the film at this point was now $100 million. In the final round of reshoots, werewolf actor Derek Mears plays Jason. We love Derek Mears. He improvised the infamous shot of the werewolf flipping off Ellie and Jimmy during rehearsal. And that makes it into the movie. I gotta tell you, that is my favorite, campiest moment of this film, is when the Judy Greer werewolf gives them the finger. And I'm just like, this is great. I'm like, it's a werewolf flipping the bird. Like, this is what the whole movie should have been. Just werewolves cursing.
We'll be right back with more of The Offering with Jerry Horror.
The term cult film itself refers to the subculture that surrounds underground films and midnight movies. A cafe is usually a small and informal establishment serving various refreshments in an intimate and inviting setting. What do you get when you combine the two? You get the Cult Cafe, located at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, New York. Every Saturday night at 10 p.m., Cult Cafe brings you the best in cult film and beloved classics, curated with care, especially for a devoted fan base of cinephiles. Cult Cafe is where box office bombs are resurrected, and more obscure, transgressive films, shunned by the mainstream, can find a home beautifully projected on a large silver screen. Past movies screened at the Cult Cafe include David Cronenberg's Videodrome, Frank Henenlotter's Basket Case, John Carpenter's The Thing, Sam Raimi's Evil Dead, Victor Bonacore's Thrust, and Richard Kelly's Donnie Darko. Man, the programming there is on point. For tickets and showtimes, head on over to cinemaartscenter.org to find a listing of films, or add Cult Cafe on Facebook to find a series of upcoming events. There really is nothing like seeing an old favorite in a theater full of your fellow movie fans. Hey, maybe I'll even see you there. Cinema will never die at the Cult Cafe. Listeners and fans of The Offering can get their hands on their very own The Offering with Jerry Horror merch, now only at Tee Public. Find your own fresh The Offering with Jerry Horror high-quality merchandise, including t-shirts, hoodies, tank tops, long sleeves, stickers, and mugs. Just like the show, we've got gear that's mostly horror, always genre. The Offering with Jerry Horror Tee Public store has everything you need to represent your favorite podcast. Folks, head on over to teepublic.com right now and pick up your very own Offering Tee today. You're listening to The Offering with Jerry Horror. Got a question or a story you want to share with me? It might be featured in a future episode. Email me at jerryhorror@gmail.com or hit me up on Twitter @jerryhorror.
I'm also on Instagram. You can find me there at Jerry Hara. Rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts, and you might find your review in an upcoming episode. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to The Offering. Now back to the show.
So Scott Nemiroff, at one point, he was brought in during reshoots to script new scenes, including an opening sequence of the werewolf jumping through the Hollywood sign, but ultimately they killed that because they said, this is going to cost too much. We don't even have Mandy Moore money anymore. We went from Mandy Moore to Maya. You're not doing the Hollywood scene. It's just not happening. So post-production, obviously, Patrick Lussier is working as an editor. He was supposed to only work on the film for 6 weeks in summer of 2003. He ended up working on this movie for 19 months. Literally, toiling for 19 months, editing, taking the three movies, possibly four, because it was the 10-day reshoot, taking all of this footage and consolidating it into one film. I mean, it's a devil's errand. It's insane. You've got all this footage, all these different actors, all these rewrites. Lussier even worked as a second unit director during the extensive reshoots. All of Rick Baker's designs were cut, and most of KNB's practical effects were replaced by CGI, including Judy Greer's transformation. Nevertheless, Rick Baker's name was displayed in the opening credits as the sole special makeup effects designer and creator, as per his contract. Hey, that's what you paid the man for. So, hey, KNB did it all mostly. They threw his stuff in the garbage. How do you do that? I'm sorry, I just can't get over it. In the fall of 2004, Dimension Films cut the film to a PG-13 rating instead of the planned R rating. Now, speaking to the New York Post, Craven commented, "The contract called for us to make an R-rated film. We did. It was a difficult process. Then it was taken away from us and cut to PG-13 and ruined. It was 2 years of very difficult work. We did 100 days, over 100 days of shooting on various versions of this film. And then at the very end, it was chopped up, and the studio thought they could make more with a PG-13, and they trashed it. I thought it was completely disrespectful, and it hurt them too. It was like they shot themselves in the foot with a shotgun." Wes Craven. Jenny's death scene in the elevator was originally much gorier. And I gotta say, Jenny, obviously, Maya, the scene in the parking garage and the elevator is like some of the most effective stuff. It was actually really scary. That really worked. I liked it. You can feel that it's supposed to be R-rated, and they're just chopping it to bits. The whole sequence with Maya was much gorier. Her dead body shown, her belly's ripped apart, and there's guts everywhere. And not even the R-rated DVD version included this scene. A picture of her mutilated body, however, was shown in a Fangoria article published before the film's release. And that became a point of contention too, because Fangoria is like, wait, we visited this movie 2 years ago and they're still... it's still not out yet, and wait, they replaced all the actors? So Fangoria had the scoop. They knew what was going on. Craven and Lussier would move on to Red Eye, the Cillian Murphy film. Great suspense thriller. It's an underrated film in his catalog. During that film's post-production, they would learn that Cursed would be edited down to accommodate a PG-13 rating, and Patrick Lussier had nothing to do with that. The studio was like, we're gonna change it again. So they brought in another editor after this poor guy worked on this movie for 19 months. A nightmare sequence featuring Jake's throat getting ripped out by Ellie was redone without Craven, instead with Joel Soyson serving as director. So they reshot stuff without Craven. How dirty is that? That's messed up. And in 2008, Craven was quoted as saying, "The Cursed experience was so screwed up. I mean, where did 2.5 years of my life go for a movie that wasn't close to anything that it should have been? I learned from the Cursed experience not to do something solely for money. And that's where I went wrong. Right up front, they told me, they're going to pay me double. I was only 10 days from shooting Pulse, and I said, fine. But I ended up working 2.5 years for double my fee. But I could have done 2.5 movies elsewhere. And done movies that were out there making money in the wild. In general, I think it's not worth it. Part of the reason my phone hasn't rung is, well, that story's pretty well known." And that was really the problem here. what they did was, Wes Craven was trying to work with other studios. They were like, hey, we want to be in the Wes Craven business. But they would just keep throwing things. And I think this was the final, thing they could do where, hey, we're going to pay you double. They just keep Craven under contract. And he's stuck involved with this movie, seeing it from the Rooter to the Tudor. How does it end? Well, in July 2021, Brian Collins from Screamfest blog did a review and comparison between the final film and both Craven's original unfinished cut and his first reshot version, which had resurfaced and, well, for the first time, surfaced from VHS work prints, and both versions were praised as superior to the final film. Now, this is not the first time when news about alternate versions of Cursed existing were reported. So this VHS work print, there's two different work prints. There's one that they say is the Craven cut. There's the other one that was put together by the studio, the one that they never supposedly test screened. Now, some years ago, Patrick Lussier mentioned how he still has copies of three unreleased versions of the film. Craven's unfinished cut, the first reshot version, and the fully uncut reshot version with all the deleted gore and practical effects by KNB from before most of their work was cut too, because you make a PG-13, all that gore is gone. So in October 2018, former Dimension COO Carrie Blanett confirmed that all original and deleted footage from Cursed still exists. It's out there. Now, I don't even know who has the rights at this point. You know, maybe it's Paramount because they own a piece of it. I think it's over there at this point. With that being said, they could release like a 3-disc set and you have 3 different versions of the film. They exist. They're just sitting. It's like, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark. They're just sitting there. You know, it's like they take these beautiful treasures that fans would go crazy for and just sitting there. You could make money. It's money left on the table with all this stuff. Cursed opens theatrically on February 25th, 2005, opened in 2,800 theaters, took in $9 million in opening weekend, and averaged about $3,400 a screen. It placed number 4 in its opening weekend. The other movies that beat Cursed: Diary of a Mad Black Woman, it's a Madea movie, which opened that weekend too. So Madea beat Wes Craven. Hitch was the number 2 movie in the country. Hitch, everybody loves Hitch. Will Smith, Hollywood weirdo. And Constantine, the ill-fated Keanu Reeves adaptation. Some people love it, some people don't. Your mileage may vary. The following weekend, the movie crumbled. Bad word of mouth. The gross went down by 60%. It came in number 7 that second week in the box office. Its 10-day total was like 15.3 million. Yeah, this is bad. By its third week, the film went to 10th place and it made like $1 million. So total, it was around $17 million in gross. It ended its theatrical run after 11 weeks on May 12th. The final take was $19 million. They think the worldwide total pulled it up probably about another $10 million. So it's about a $30 million gross worldwide on the $100 million they spent to make this movie 3 times. 3. Count them, 3. The San Francisco Chronicle wrote, "Cursed is a third-rate effort with a weak script, cheap-looking effects, and no genuine frights." Oh, this is pretty bad. This is from Film Threat. "Until this past Friday, the worst werewolf film ever made was Harry Hands Down Mike Nichols' Wolf. Cursed now assumes that dubious distinction, and someone is going to have to try very hard to wrestle it away." Cinema Blend, giving the film 2 out of 5 stars, felt that Cursed isn't a bad film and actually takes a unique approach to modern-day genre movies by styling itself as an older one. This is a fun little romp in the werewolf world. Cursed never really sets any rules for the creatures themselves, leaving itself to keep cute faces like Richie's uncovered by makeup, but leaving the audience unsatisfied that there aren't really many werewolves in this werewolf movie. That's the problem. You get sporadic bursts of the werewolves, but you don't get as much as you would think. I do like that at least you get 5 minutes of a cold open and then you get your first werewolf attack. I appreciate that. It's a 90-minute movie. Considering all the footage they shot, this thing should just be wall-to-wall werewolves. Well, that's our new podcast, Wall-to-Wall Werewolves. Okay, let's talk about home media, because you guys are nerds. When it was released on DVD in the US, June 21st, 2005, two versions were available, the original theatrical version, which was 97 minutes, and an unrated version, which contains the footage cut to obtain a PG-13 rating and runs approximately 2 minutes longer. The film received its Blu-ray release on September 11th, 2012. Nothing else happened on that day, just the release of Cursed. That was through Echo Bridge Entertainment in a double feature with another Wes Craven film, They. He produced that. He didn't make that. The disc only contains the theatrical cut with that two-pack. The film was released individually for the first time in the United States on Blu-ray by Shout Factory, featuring the theatrical and extended cut in April 2022. There's some good special features on that disc. A little too rich for my blood. We got to start a Patreon so I can start collecting all of these different Blu-rays and 4K iterations. It gets expensive, kids. Of course, I guess we have to talk about this. Hashtag release the Craven cut. On October 30th of 2018, former Dimension COO Carrie Blanett revealed in an interview with Bloody Disgusting that the original footage still exists, we talked about this, inspired Twitter users and the Sight and Sound podcast calling for Craven's cut using the hashtag release the Craven cut with Bloody Disgusting and YouTuber Cody Leach, calling it the most anticipated horror movie director's cut. They tried to Snyder cut this thing. They tried. I mean, it didn't really work out. Editor Patrick Lussier commented on the movement in early July 2021, stating that a release of the original cut of the film was very unlikely due to the ending never being shot, and also due to a lack of popularity, as opposed to, like, Zack Snyder's Justice League. Lussier claimed that he had no idea who owned the rights to the film due to various Miramax properties reverting to other companies, leaving the future of any alternate cut in doubt. Look, I don't think that Cursed is a bad movie. It's entertaining, but it's a Frankenstein monster. And you can feel sometimes it's silly, sometimes it's serious, sometimes it's supernatural, sometimes it's more grounded. It truly is this monstrosity. You could put it on. It's PG-13. It's a good gateway horror. If you got some kids, you got some teenagers, you're trying to get them in, this is a good movie. It's a 90-minute werewolf movie, in, out. No frills. 2014, Judy Greer spoke of the film in an interview. I don't know why that movie got so fucked up. I don't understand it. I thought the script was fine. Honest to God, I didn't get the big deal. I don't know who kept making them fuck with it. Then we shot the movie for like 7 years, it felt like. I think they said we had 4 movies worth of footage when it was all said and done. It was so fun, but so weird. It was like Groundhog's Day, but we were shooting a movie. I don't get it. I couldn't figure it out. In 2018, Christina Ricci also briefly spoke about the film in an interview. It was one of those studio movies that just got horribly screwed up, and the less said, the better. In 2019, Jesse Eisenberg gave his thoughts about the troubled production in the film. The first movie was more interesting and provocative, the one with Skeet Ulrich. I don't know why it wasn't working. Now that we know the behind the scenes of the Weinstein Company, it makes sense as to why it was so chaotic. They filmed like 90% of the bigger budget version. The first movie was this very splashy thing. The second version was cutting corners in a lot of different ways because they were running out of money. And the plot? I thought it was ridiculous. It was so stupid. I thought the plot was so cliche. They made us brother and sister. The things that they kept from the original film were like little snippets, like a car rolling down a hill. Like, they kept that shot. But most of the heart, it was gone. This movie ultimately made Wes Craven walk away from directing completely. For a hot minute, it broke him as a creator. He never wanted to even work on a movie. He really thought about retiring at that point. He was done. Wes Craven has always said the worst thing that he did was The Hills Have Eyes Part 2, which came out the same year as A Nightmare on Elm Street in 1984. You know, big highs, big lows. He basically did Hills 2 for a paycheck. He was going through a really messy divorce and he needed the money. One of the biggest hits of his career matched with a movie he didn't want to do. But, you know, those bills ain't going to pay themselves. So I think if we've learned anything from all these different Miramax and Dimension films that I've covered over the past few years, sick plug, I personally wish that Wes was able to independently score financing and make whatever the fuck he wanted to tell his truth without Harvey fucking Weinstein breathing down his back what would have those years been like? Had you been able to work with younger talent, new screenwriters, and emerging actors? God, what could have been? But we got cursed. And love it or hate it, it's not a bad movie. It just doesn't live up to what it could be. The whodunit premise of a werewolf and Wes Craven and Kevin Williamson and all these things coming together, it sounds like magic on paper. But ultimately, it was just another movie that Harvey Weinstein fucked up. I always wanted better for Wes Craven. Like, I felt like he was kind of owned by the Weinsteins. And I think had he been given a chance, he would have done some different and really interesting things. But he was too far into the machine and the machinations that they had trapped him within to create these things that he really had no interest in. Do you think by the time they got to like the 101st day of shooting Cursed, like he even gave a shit at that point? Everybody was just clocking in. Come on. Some movies are movies, and other movies are just a financial obligation. So if you file Cursed, file it under F for financial obligation. All right, folks, let's pull it in with our final unhinged review of the season. It is an unhinged review that is so good, so concise, and so on topic that we could possibly never do any, and no review could follow this. Maybe I built it up too big. This comes off of Amazon. This is a verified purchase, 4 out of 5 stars, verified purchase of Cursed Blu-ray. This is the one by Shout Factory. Oh, this is Angela Sylvester title. I still don't like all the CGI in this. Body of the review. I still don't like all the CGI in this. Thanks. THNX. Thanks. Thanks for what? Not only that, like, here's the thing. Are you reviewing the Blu-ray or are you reviewing the movie? Because if you're reviewing the movie, I don't know. That's a good question. Do you get what I'm saying? It's like, are you reviewing the presentation of the film? Is she giving it 4 out of 5 stars because the movie has all the CGI? And I got to tell you, I know this is an unhinged review, and sorry, Angela Sylvester, I don't want to interrupt or take away from your shine, but it's kind of one of these things where early on, when I had found out that Rick Baker's work had been completely replaced, I was like all bent out of shape. I'm like, oh, they fucking hate practical effects and take away the goddamn CGI. You know, old man yells at cloud. So it's kind of one of these things where I'm like, is this CGI going to be jarring or bad, like in a Mummy Returns type of way? And I watched it again. It's not terrible. It's fine. It's early aughts CGI. Live with it. You know, it is what it is. One thing I can't live with, though, the way this movie ends, it has like one of these like bullshit flowery songs from like a WB show where it's like, I am cursed and the curse will go on. It's like very like Dido, WB 2003. Oof, it's fucking bad. I don't know. It's fine. It's, you know, I think when it comes down to it, it's about what it could have been and not what it is. Considering the state of physical media and some of these companies just not really embracing it the way they should and using it as a pipeline to make more money, I don't think we're ever going to see those 3 different versions of Blu-ray, 3 different versions of the film, like it's going to come to a 4K or something. Maybe, I don't know. I think a boutique label could pick it up if they get the rights from Paramount. I'm sure that, because that was the other word too, that Shout was trying to get that. But ultimately, I think at the end of the day, they were just like, you get the movie, you get this cut with 2 more minutes. What else do we get? That's it. But it's got some good special features, so definitely pick up the Shout Factory disc. Well, folks, that's it. Season 3 is in the books. We're done. I mean, this was an amazing season. Big swings, you know, big swings in summer blockbusters. And we took them. A lot of weird movies we covered. Thank you for allowing us to move a little bit outside of our comfort zone, the horror genre, and take you to some different places. The way that I've always looked at this show in my mind is that it is like a library. And you have all kinds of different things. You have different genres, different films, different filmmakers. And yeah, the bulk of it is gonna be horror and genre stuff. But occasionally I want someone to look up on that shelf and say, wow, Tim Burton made a Planet of the Apes movie? Holy shit, did you guys know about this? Wait, that Tim Burton? No, yeah, it's that, yeah. So it's kind of one of those things, because I can imagine that happening to a bunch of kids today. Like, really? That guy? The director of Wednesday made an Apes movie? Wow. Mind blown. I'm very fortunate, very thankful for everyone who helped with this season. This was a rough year for me, as far as all the shit that I went through in my life. We, like I said before, just when you think you've hit the bottom of the barrel, life, or the horror genre, has a basement, and it goes even deeper. I lost my good friend Jeremy this year, and unfortunately, he couldn't cope with a lot of shit, and he took his own life. And I've been told that grief is a long and deep valley, and it can be a lonesome journey, but it doesn't have to be. But it takes time. If you or anyone you know is thinking about suicide or needs to talk to somebody, you can call or text 988 right now, and someone will be there to talk. Even if you got to text me or email me, whatever. Yeah, you'll probably get a hold of them first. I sleep during the day. I'm a complete nocturnal animal at this point. Yep, just like the possums and whatever. There's a lot of nocturnal animals. Bats are nocturnal. I could be like the Batman. Wow. But you can be like the Batman. Tell people to call or text 988 if they're having any kind of crisis. Because ultimately, folks, we're here to help each other. And if we can't do that, then what the fuck are we doing? Seriously. I didn't want to end this on a down note, but it had to be said because that was where I started this season. It hung heavy on me to create something, an entire season that was worthy of someone's legacy and memory. And as we pull up to Jeremy's birthday, he would have been 45 this year. Our birthdays were 20-something days apart. We always celebrated our birthdays. We had a good time. And unfortunately, he's not here for this. So I got to do double good. I got to make sure that I'm doing double great for the both of us. So I think Jeremy would be proud of this season. He would probably even be like, wow, he's like, you really did a fucking Xanadu episode? I'm like, yes, Jeremy, we did a Xanadu episode. He's like, that's not a horror movie. I'm like, Jeremy, I'm aware that's not a fucking horror movie. He's like, you should probably stay in your lane. And then I say, whatever. I'm fucking Napoleon Dynamite talking to the ghost of my friend on the exiting outro of season 3. Jesus, man. This is some rough stuff, but I will tell you, life goes on. I'm doing good. And the reason that I'm doing good was because I took some accountability. I see a therapist every week. I see a psychiatrist. I take my meds. I exercise. I try to eat properly. I try to get proper rest and sleep. I do all the things that adults are supposed to do for my own mental health and well-being, which had always been a factor in my life that had been a problem. But once Jeremy was gone, and the way that he was gone, I was like, shit, I gotta make some changes. So I have been. And I've been kicking some ass. I've been doing really good. My blood pressure is normal. My cholesterol is normal. I have a normal A1C. I basically put diabetes, in its place. No, in all seriousness, I really improved my health. I'm on my way to becoming a swole Superman or a fitness influencer. I'm a fitness influencer, but I like horror movies. That's my angle. We're going to do abs, bro, but we're going to do them. We're going to watch Night of the Comet. That's me smoking cigarettes. No, I don't smoke cigarettes. But yeah, I've made a lot of great improvements in my life. This show is a part of that. 3 years ago, when we started this show, I came from a very dark place. And slowly but surely, producer Pete, he pulled me out of the darkness. And he unveiled me to the world, just like the Lion King. Like, look, it's Simba. But it's me. And it's like fat, hairy me. You know what I'm saying? Like, and people are like, you know what? I liked the little lion, but whatever this fucking guy is, I'm not too sold on him. Either way, you know, on the social medias, you can follow me. Stay tuned, man. We got bite-size offerings coming. We've got some really cool stuff that I can't talk about right now because it's still in the early stages, but there's a lot on the horizon for old Jerry Hara. I'm going to ride off into the sunset because, hey, even Jerry deserves a little bit of a happy ending, right? Don't we all? I'm Jerry Hara. This has been The Offering. Mostly horror, always genre. You've been listening to The Offering with Jerry Hara. I'm very sorry. Produced by Pete Bune. If you have a question or a story you want to share with me, we'd love to hear from you. You can email me at jerryhara@gmail.com or hit us up at Twitter @jerryhara or on Instagram @jerryhara. You get in the picture? Subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are provided for you and your family. I want you to enjoy. Just join us next time for another offer.
This has been a Sick Boy Wolfgang production. Thank you for listening.